This message is brought to you by DoNotAge.org, the longevity research organisation that's on a mission to extend health span for as many people as possible via products that actually work. Start your journey today at DoNotAge.org and use code LAMA for a 10% discount. That's LLAMA.
I'm not saying that you need a mass market approach, but you need to be on those platforms and communicate in the ways that people communicate. So if you're a doctor, a primary care doctor, and you have 1,000 patients, you should have 1,000 followers on your Instagram who are those patients.
Hello and welcome to the Live Long and Master Aging podcast. I'm Peter Bowes. This is where we explore the science and stories behind human longevity. Today and for the next few weeks, we're at TED Med. In beautiful La Quinta, California, TED Med is the TED conference that focuses on health and medical issues. And for this first episode, I'm joined by James Hamblin. James is a doctor, an improv comedian, a journalist, currently senior editor of The Atlantic, host of the video series If Our Bodies Could Talk, and author of the book by the same name. James, welcome to the LAMA podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's good to see you. If your body could talk, what would it be saying to you right now? Do you get that question a lot?
It does come up a lot. I'd say Palm Springs is a pretty ideal place to live. I should probably think more seriously about moving to the desert.
It's kind of pretty idyllic, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a little eerie. It's like Disney World for adults.
I agree with you, it's a beautiful place. Yeah. Well, I want to talk about human longevity, which is what we're all about, and your work as well. But let's go back to the beginning. For you are a doctor, but you're a journalist these days, you're a writer. So I'm curious what resulted in the transition from medicine to writing.
How much time do you have?
As long as you want.
I went to medical school and then I started doing radiology, which I was doing that at UCLA, and I was performing improv and stand-up comedy at night in the LA comedy scene, and just found that I was a lot happier when I was doing comedy. And at the same time, I saw...
That can be a pretty tough world, can't it? The LA improv scene.
Yeah. Well, it can be tough when you're trying to make a living out of it. It was nice for me because I was doing it recreationally.
Right.
I'm sure it would be very stressful, yeah, to try to be booking gigs and whatnot, as they say. So I did feel a little torn. And also at the same time, I realized that I just really like writing and speaking, and there are these huge gaps in public knowledge in medicine and science, that there's a lot of ground to be gained in terms of health if we could do better at filling those gaps. So I took some time and went and did journalism for a little bit and then really liked it. So now I've been doing it for 5 years.
Was there any sense of, and I talked to a lot of doctors, of dissatisfaction with the world of medicine, how it operates, that perhaps you were disillusioned to some extent?
Yeah, absolutely. I really liked studying radiology and the pathology of it and figuring out the disease processes and solving the puzzles. But then when I got into the day-to-day practice, it was a lot of just real incremental studies that seemed possibly totally unnecessary, possibly leading to more studies that we could have avoided or procedures that we didn't necessarily need. And I was just unsure how much good I was really doing. At the same time, there are these huge health problems in the world, and maybe I was just a little young and idealistic, but also just sitting, the radiologists sitting in dark rooms all day generating reports, and it takes a very special kind of person to be able to do that day in and day out, which was not me.
So one of the other things that doctors often tell me is that when they look back on their medical training, they realize, with the benefit of hindsight, what they weren't trained to do. And one of the big issues is always nutrition and food, that most physicians say, well, maybe 30 minutes, that's all we were taught. Was that something that occurred to you?
Yeah, we got very little training, and that was the norm. And I hear a lot of physicians saying the same thing, and really focused on treating disease with the medicines that were, what can you do as an MD that could not be done by someone else? So, well, at the same time, I think nutrition and food should deserve a much bigger place in medical curriculum. I also understand, I think, where that was coming from, because nutritionists and all kinds of other people can counsel people on eating, and they can't necessarily do the procedure, write the prescription that a physician can.
You kind of alluded to this a little earlier. In terms of, I think, what people think about the medical profession and the confusion that reigns in terms of their own health, what they read in magazines, what they see in headlines on television. And people often say, well, look, I don't really know what to do. Do you feel their pain in that sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Doctors have done generally a bad job of getting ahead of and incorporating ourselves into the media messages that are widespread. For a long time, we have thought that it is only within the bounds of our profession to speak to students in medical schools, to deliver lectures at hospitals, and to write in academic journals. And occasionally, maybe to provide comment should you be reached by a reporter, should they somehow manage to find your contact info and schedule an appointment with you. And meanwhile, the national dialogue is going on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, and this is where everyone is seeing the sponsored ad from Kim Kardashian for the dietary supplement that they believe they need to take, or the skin cream that's going to clear up their eczema. And that's reaching so many more people in a single post than some doctors are reaching in their entire career. And I'm not saying we totally need to move in that direction, but we have done, we need to have big platforms and big voices, which I think a lot of physicians are just now realizing as they start to look into this void of misinformation and distrust in science and say, how did this happen and what can I do? And why do I have 10 Twitter followers and Donald Trump has 26 million and he says he doesn't think vaccines are a good idea?
Mm. So doctors and medics need to take the Kim Kardashian approach, the celebrity approach, the blitzing of the mass market approach.
No, I'm not saying that at all.
I know you kind of said it as a joke, but I mean, there's a serious question there that doctors need to get real with what people are reading.
I'm not saying that you need a mass market approach, but you need to be on those platforms and communicate in the ways that people communicate. So if you're a doctor, a primary care doctor, and you have 1,000 patients, you should have 1,000 followers on your Instagram who are those patients. Probably because they check their Instagram and you're not going to reach as many people as anyone else, but as a celebrity, but that should be part of your practice. When there's some new guideline or something that you find yourself repeating over and over again about, you know, diet or exercise or anything that could be helpful, you know, put it out there and just be part of a positive information and trust building and relationship building practice for the entire profession in places where we tend to be just totally absent until something has gone very wrong, until there are tons of people not vaccinating their kids or following terrible diets or not signing up for insurance when they should be or whatever.
If you were teaching doctors today about getting their message across in a realistic way, there's a whole new level of education that's needed. And we're not just talking about teaching them about nutrition. It's about getting the message across in a relatable way.
Yeah, I think that has a lot to do with selection of who becomes a medical student too. I think we need more people who've studied humanities, who are into the arts, who are simply good at communicating. I think the knowledge base that you're going to need in order to be a doctor is going to continue to shrink as we have AI-assisted algorithms that can help us. We don't have to memorize all the side effects of a medication. We used to have to memorize a differential diagnosis of some rare disease. We can quickly look up, you know, the 3 times in our decades of practice we have to use it. What we can't do is teach people. You can improve people's communication skills and try to advocate empathy, but I think these are things that we could just also just do a better job selecting for. And then not expecting every doctor to have a really be really great at communicating on every platform, but maybe try one to say, you know what I could do? I could get an email listserv going for people who are interested in knowing more about type 2 diabetes, and I could write a good email once a week, and maybe I could get 100,000 people reading it, you know, and that'd be more people than I would normally reach in my entire practice. Or maybe I'm good at Snapchat or, you know, Instagram or whatever is your platform, whatever, however you like to communicate, and find a way to do that.
So where did your passion come from to answer these, a lot of the quirky questions that you tackle? And it really is your hallmark to some extent, especially in the videos. You know, should I be drinking red wine? Why is red wine good for me, supposedly? And the list goes on.
Yeah, these questions just keep coming up in my own personal life. As soon as people find out I'm a doctor, they just start. You see the patterns emerge of what is on the front of people's minds. So I put all those questions together in a book so that I wouldn't have to constantly be answering them. But I think that's a way to make it clear that this is a fun, lighthearted article or piece that will interest people who would not pick up the actual journal article on which the piece is based.
Which, frankly, most people are never going to do.
Right. Not only do they not have access to it, but it's written in this language, which even we doctors feel it can be hard for someone who's not an expert in a particular field to get through it, much less to want to. We don't write in journal articles as if we have any interest in pulling someone through the article and having them finish it. The only objective seems to be to put facts onto the page and not leave anything out.
Well, it's to some extent what I tried to do as well. And just before we started recording, we were talking about diet and fasting in particular. And my interest in that stemmed from a clinical trial where I was actually one of the volunteers because I was curious about the process, what it's like to be a volunteer in a clinical trial. And then actually look and see it through and look at the results and how that's interpreted, especially by the popular press. And the particular trial that I was involved with was looking at a 5-day fasting mimicking diet, which I've talked a lot about on this podcast. And I know you've got views about that and the other fasting, the popular fasting diets that are around, like that the 5-2 diet as well.
Yeah. Well, so I'm less interested and less knowledgeable on the hard science of what might actually be happening in the brain and body of someone who follows that to a T for years. And I'm more interested in the behavioral psychology of what is actually going to work for people and what are they actually going to be able to remember and focus on. Because I think it's very few things. People like you and I who are really into health and science are just thinking about this so much more than most people do, which is not to say people are stupid or wasting their time. They just have other more, they're thinking about being a lawyer or selling real estate or getting their kids to their doctor's appointments or whatever, like a million different things. And there are a few things like eat less sugar, avoid gluten, fat is bad, you know, messages that were so repeated for so long that they got through into people's heads. And then when you're talking about, you know, maintaining a 5-2 diet, you're really, that's a small population. So anyway, but I do think it's really interesting physiology. And I think the idea that generally we do not need to eat 3 meals a day, that you can go for prolonged periods without eating and it can be healthy for you. And that if you should not eat if you're not hungry, you should feel good skipping breakfast or lunch. And so I try to, in my own life, just not eat. I never make myself eat. And I will find myself going long periods without eating and then eating a lot and eating at just totally irregular intervals. And I know there's different data on that, but I think it's at least part of the problem is this idea that we really need to have 3 big meals a day. And if you're feeling, and that we don't know what hunger is. We don't, if you're feeling the slightest twinge of hunger, you need a snack.
Well, I think it goes back to a different age when we worked in a different way, when access to food was different. I mean, food is all around us all the time now. Maybe for some generations it wasn't like that, and that you actually had to work hard to prepare food, to get to food. And so the regimen of 3 meals a day perhaps worked then, but now it doesn't. And we've got food meal substitutes that come in a bottle that are actually oftentimes very good and very well balanced, and they're convenient. So we can move with the times, I think, is what I'm saying. And I totally agree that if you get by on 2 meals a day, that's great.
Yeah. I think the being comfortable with hunger and learning what it means to feel really hungry is just important. It's just something that so many people go so long with.
How does it feel to you, being hungry? Is it a positive?
It goes through stages. So I'll first kind of start to feel pretty negative and down, but then you push through that and it goes away. It doesn't have to be remedied by food. But that's real hunger. I mean, you don't need to get to the point of feeling bad.
There's hunger and there's starvation, isn't there?
Yeah.
I mean, starvation takes weeks
to get to. I'm certainly not advocating and never have experienced myself.
Of course. Yeah, exactly.
But I just mean getting up before work and eating at 6:30 and then not eating again till nighttime. And at a point in there, if you're not used to doing it, you might start to feel pretty lousy and grouchy.
Mm. But it goes in waves, doesn't it? That sort of grouchiness phase, which I think actually goes completely after a couple of days because you get used to it and actually learn to embrace it and to embrace the mental highs that come with it as well.
Yeah. It's kind of, not to get too level, high concept, but when you deprive yourself of anything, you know, you go in stages of kind of missing it. When you try to treat anything with, you know, whether it's relationship or acquiring material goods or exercising or anything that you might do regularly. And
tech, not looking at your phone.
Yeah, yeah. The answer is almost never to just, every time you have an impulse, just feed it. You develop a healthy relationship with the feeling of deprivation and the feeling of satisfying that need.
Actually, talking of looking at your phone and managing your use of technology, what are your views on that? I know you've written about this. Everyone these days is talking about putting your phone down 6:30 at night and easing your way into the evening and turning the lights down because there's food and there's exercise and there's spirituality, but we're totally absorbed by the technology around us these days, and that it's not doing as much good.
I think that's a blind spot for doctors that we don't see. It's not necessarily that any of the technology is specifically bad. It's that it's replacing other things that we could be doing, which we know are good, and that there is something about interacting with people face-to-face and watching their faces, and we laugh more and we report feeling better at the end of it. Even if it's, you know, you could be talking, emailing online with someone you like a lot more than the person you actually have next to you who you could talk to. But something about that face-to-face interaction, and that's how, and there's so many fewer misunderstandings and so much more empathy and compassion that you could talk to someone who politically disagrees with you a lot more easily and with a lot less stress on the part of either of you when you do it in person. And
it's actually just to interrupt slightly, it's one of the reasons I try to do these interviews face to face, because I know so many of us are used to doing everything remotely, and remote is supposed to be good and convenient and you can get more done. But there is something about looking someone in the eye and just understanding what they're saying to you and how they feel about what you're talking about.
Right. Although you and I seem to already agree about everything.
Yeah, well, we can work on that.
I think we need to really think seriously about adopting these technologies as wholeheartedly and without question and without diet regimens. And doctors need to start asking about our relationships to that technology alongside smoking and drinking and sex and sleep and whatever else they might be asking about.
The theme of this event, the TEDMED event, is think limitless. If you are thinking limitless about the world and maybe your aspirations in the world, what would you be aiming for?
Too big of a question for me. I like to make things... my approaches for health is to try to think of sort of small, tangible things that people can act on and do and remember to do.
So real world things.
Yeah, I'm not good at reporting on climate change, and people do not seem to care to read about the polar ice caps melting or about 20-year projections. We just heard it, or it just seems too abstract and too big and there's nothing you can do about it. But I wrote about this study that said that if the food system has a huge impact on the environment, and a lot of people know that maybe if they went vegan, they would have a smaller impact. And that's too big of a change for people. But if everyone in the United States switched from eating beef to eating beans, we could make something between 40 to 60% of the way to our 2020 climate emissions goals just by making that one change. Mm. So one change of food in your life could have, you know, potentially a huge impact. And that's the kind of thing that I think people could look at a menu and say, okay, I'm trying to do vegetables instead of beef.
Talking of diet, what is your diet?
Oh, yeah, I try to be plant-based as much as I can, minimally processed. I think these are two things that people can remember and live by.
We do agree on too much, don't we?
And I'm not saying that people should not be vegan or that processing is bad. I think those are kind of just the two top line things that everyone could remember, and it will steer them in the right direction.
And if you could, you, because I get asked it a lot, could you encapsulate in a short answer why plant-based?
Because I think that the environment is more important, at least equally important, to our food choices as is human health, and that animal agriculture has all kinds of externalities, from antibiotics to deforestation to usages of energy and water and emission, greenhouse gas emissions, that are urgent threats to the future of humanity. So it's almost negligible to me to ask about the nutritional profile of beef versus beans. And no one's going to become protein deficient from switching. And So that's, I think, and then diversity and high fiber are good leading ideas. But when you eat plant-based, you tend to do that because no one just gets up and eats all apples for breakfast and all apples for lunch. And you get a high nutrient, high fiber, sustainable diet.
Do you think, this is what we talk about all the time, do you think about your own longevity, your own health span or lifespan? Do you have a goal that you focus on?
No, I don't really think that far ahead.
It's never crossed your mind what might be,
it
how
just
far you'd like to get?
It seems too far away.
And just to put this in perspective, then you're in your early 30s now?
I'm 35, actually.
35, you're mid-30s now.
Yeah.
So that leads me to a question I was just going to get to, but I'll mention it now. Everything I read about you, the first line pretty much mentions how young you look. If you don't look 35, they mention Doogie Howser and all the same. You do look very young.
Oh, thank you.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's just because my parents look young. I tend to be in pretty good spirits, and I like eating well and working out, and I like getting enough sleep, and I think these are things that can potentially wear on you. I've also lived a very, very fortunate life and not had to have a great deal of stress on me, other than like self-imposed stupid kinds of stress.
What puts stress on you?
Every single time I publish anything, I worry that you always could have done it better. You know, it doesn't mean that you got a fact wrong. It just means even if it was a perfectly executed article, which is never true, you just think of, well, could we have done a smarter headline, or could we have published it at a different time? Or there's just a million things that you could always be worrying about.
And you do worry about it?
I'm becoming a little more focused on the bigger picture. That's what was missing in radiology for me, is I didn't have this obsessiveness, which you want your radiologist to have. You want your radiologist to kind of go home at night and just be kicking themselves that they should have maybe included one more thing in that report that probably was nothing, but they're just, you know, staying up at night worrying about it. And that's how I'm about journalism, and I wasn't quite that way about radiology. So that's my advice when I talk to younger people, is to find a career where, not to drive you to the point of stress, bad health, but where you really feel that consumed by it. I think that means you have meaning and purpose, and that gives you longevity.
Yeah, I'm sure it does. And so how do you cope with the stress that does affect you? Those worrying times, and you're reading the headline the next day and thinking, could have been slightly better. Do you ponder over it and stew over it?
I try to channel it into doing something better, because part of the problem of, you know, like we're talking about people not understanding of the problem of mainstream media and the news cycle moving so quickly, that contributes to people not having a clear idea of what truth is in science. But that also gives you an opportunity as a journalist to remember that you get a chance to start over the next day, not start completely, but to do something, and whatever thing you feel like you could have done better, make sure you do it better that time.
You mentioned a news cycle, which is a phrase we hear forever these days. Do you think news cycles are bad for people? Do you think news is bad for people?
Yeah. I think there's something unifying in having a national conversation, that we're all thinking about things because, for example, the president said something bad, you know, stupid, that, you know, we're talking about the Civil War at this moment in the United States 150 years after it ended, and maybe that's what we needed to have. So you have this national conversation, which is good, but the it's really bad for health and science, though, normally, that people only want to hear what's new and novel and don't want to read about history and don't want to go back. And it's hard to want to read anything that isn't what everybody else is talking about at the moment. It's like, you know, if like, the internet's sort of like a party or like a social scene that you're logging into, you don't just go on there and start wanting to talk about a thing that is a five-year-old book, even if that five-year-old book really was the best synopsis of nutrition that we have. So yeah, I wish there was no news cycle. Or you could listen to like a five-minute synopsis of the news in a day and then move on to like bigger things.
Mm. I mean, for some people, it's got to the stage where they can't look away, though. It's that stereotypical car crash about to happen that people don't want to look away because they think it's going to affect them, but then they do look and it stresses them out.
Yeah, which is also a privileged position to have, which I'm fortunate. Like you hear people, President Trump talking about immigration bans and the idea that, you know, people will be deported and families will be broken up and people's lives will be ruined. And I'm not affected by that. And it feels crazy for me to complain about being stressed about that. I mean,
the stress.
Yeah. So then I feel also maybe that I should be looking at it more. And
is some stress good for us?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like they're sort of being nervous before an exam, probably for a good reason.
Yeah. You just have to figure out how to channel it into something that motivates you, right? I think, most of us have had the feeling of being on vacation and just feeling kind of, you're just wandering around. There's no real, like, nothing really matters. And it's easy to start feeling totally unmotivated, like you didn't do anything all day. And that's good very occasionally. But I think you want a certain level of, there is objectively so much going on in the world that it matters and is important, and people who need you, that if you're not feeling stressed about it, then you have your head in the sand.
And at a personal level, you're speaking at this event this week. Will you be nervous before you stand up in front of the audience?
I don't know.
And if so, maybe that's a good thing.
Probably because it feels so curated, and I love improvisation, and I like speaking off the cuff, but it feels that way when I do it, and I'm not good at these really polished remarks, so it's not going to sound like that.
it is probably the most curated. I know I've been to Atlantic conferences as well, and they are a little bit more relaxed than the way that they do things at TED. Is not to say that the TED way is bad, it's just different, but as you say, very curated.
It's a great exercise for me to think about it and to think about speaking in a different way, because I instinctively am turned off when I see someone who seems like they are just delivering prepared remarks. That's why I don't like stand-up comedy, and I love improv comedy. Even if the jokes are not as funny or there's no jokes at all, I just love seeing people in the moment thinking something through and working it out. And not that I want everyone to come up there and just talk off the cuff, but I like it.
I wouldn't last very long.
I like it best when someone seems to be, whenever anything happens on stage that seems to be unexpected. You know, you're watching like Saturday Night Live and someone starts laughing or someone's mustache starts falling off. The whole audience loves it and they're cracking up because that was a deviation from the expectations. And so
that's human nature, isn't it?
Yeah.
That we love things going wrong.
Well, I think you like it going wrong, but even if someone is just laughing at a joke, it's not necessarily going wrong. The sketch didn't get totally messed up. You just like that they're showing this is real. This is actually happening right in front of you, and people react to real things in the world. And I'm hoping something catastrophic happens during my talk.
I look forward to that. So you don't think very much about growing old. You don't think of your own longevity, but what is motivating you right now? Is there something in your mind looking ahead to the future that you'd like to achieve?
Yeah, I'd like to have kids. And I'd like to try to not be part of the problem with media.
I think the problem with media.
Yeah. Well, like we're talking about the news cycle, like, are we right. contributing to more of a sense of chaos with just constantly telling new stories about everything? And how do we keep reminding people that the basics of what we know about diet and sleep and relationships and all the stuff that's really most important to health, and it really doesn't change overnight. Rarely is it revolutionized, and yet it seems like there's a story every day that tells you that it is.
It's interesting to me, and just in closing, that your first response to that question, I ask a lot of people the same question, was, I want to have kids. That people look to their own future, and it actually revolves around their children.
Yeah. I mean, you know, children are extensions of ourselves.
Of course.
I think that that's how you continue to... I think, you know, we talk a lot about these days about people, like, and how they're going to be remembered by history. And it's bizarre because people don't remember what happened last week. People don't remember much about any of the, you know, wonderful speeches that President Obama gave and this, stuff that's just happened very recently. You have a vague notion. And then the following generation is just basically totally gone. People struggle to quote one thing that FDR said. And much less their own grandparent. So I'm not so worried about like a legacy, and I really don't have the hubris to think that my own work is going to have a huge impact on the world. So it's more about people I might be able to mentor or teach or actually raise as kids when I think about the future.
James, it's been great to meet you and to talk to you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And if you'd like more information about James's work at The Atlantic and his video series, If Our Bodies Could Talk, it's all on the show notes page for this episode. You'll find them at Live Long and Master Aging, our website, llamapodcast.com. That's llamapodcast.com. You can get in touch from there or via one of our social sites. We're at Llama Podcast on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. I'm at Peter Bowes. And I'd love to hear from you what you think of this interview and indeed perhaps what you'd like us to talk about in the future. Many thanks for listening. FlexBeam is a portable red light therapy device that's now being used by leading athletes, including the Norwegian tennis player Casper Ruud.
Whenever you put the FlexBeam on, you feel it starts to work right away. I need something that can help repair all the fibers that I have broken in the serves.
The infrared lights penetrate your skin and makes the muscle tissue recover faster. FlexBeam, I keep it with me all the time.
Recharge Health is offering Llama Podcast listeners an $80 discount on the purchase of a FlexBeam device. Go to the website recharge.health and use the code LLAMA at checkout. That's LLAMA. You'll also find the link in the show notes for this episode.